my chest and twist until my ribs popped and my heart burst through into her hands and she could squeeze, twist, rip my life out of me. This was a monster, a hunter, a killer. This was a predator, a soulless and evil thing, just like me. But her granola smile returned very quickly. "What is it, honey?" she said, ever so sweetly, so perfectly, last nurse. My tongue felt much too large for my mouth, and it seemed like it took me several minutes to answer, but I finally managed to say, "He doesn't want the shot." She smiled again, a beautiful thing that sat on her face like the blessing of an all-wise God. "Your dad is very sick," she said. "He's in a lot of pain." She held the needle up, and a melodramatic shaft of light from the window hit it. The needle sparkled like her very own holy grail. "He needs a shot," she said. "He doesn't want it," I said. "He's in pain," she said. Harry said something I could not hear. My eyes were locked on the nurse, and hers on mine, two monsters standing over the same meat. Without looking away from her, I leaned down next to him. "I want pain," Harry said. It jerked my gaze down to him. Behind the emerging skeleton, nestled snugly under the crew cut that seemed suddenly too big for his head, Harry had returned and was fighting his way up through the fog. He nodded at me, reached very slowly for my hand, and squeezed. I looked back at last nurse. "He wants the pain," I told her, and somewhere in her small frown, the petulant shake of her head, I heard the roar of a savage beast watching its prey scuttle down a hole. "I'll have to tell the doctor," she said. "All right," I told her. "We'll wait here." I watched her sail out into the hallway like some large and deadly bird. I felt a pressure on my hand. Harry watched me watching last nurse. "You can tell," Harry said. "About the nurse?" I asked him. He closed his eyes and nodded lightly just once. "Yes," I said. "I can tell."
"Like you," Harry said.
"What?" Deborah demanded. "What are you talking about? Daddy, are you all right? What does that mean, like you?" "She likes me," I said. "He thinks the nurse may have a crush on me, Deb," I told her, and turned back to Harry.
"Oh, right," Deborah muttered, but I was already concentrating on Harry.
"What has she done?" I asked him. He tried to shake his head and managed only a slight wobble. He winced. It was clear to me that the pain was coming back, just like he'd wanted.
"Too much," he said. "She gives too much."
He gasped now and closed his eyes. I must have been rather stupid that day, because I didn't get what he meant right away. "Too much what?" I said. Harry opened one pain-bleared eye.
"Morphine," he whispered.
I felt like a great shaft of light had hit me.
"Overdose," I said. "She kills by overdose. And in a place like this, where it's actually almost her job, nobody would question it. Why, that's..."
Harry squeezed my hand again, and I stopped babbling.
"Don't let her,"
he said in a hoarse voice with surprising strength.
"Don't let her dope me again."
"Please," Deborah said in a voice that hung on the ragged edge. "What are you guys talking about?" I looked at Harry, but Harry closed his eyes as a sudden stab of pain tore at him. "He thinks, I started and then trailed off. Deborah had no idea what I was, of course, and Harry had told me quite firmly to keep her in the dark. So how I could tell her about this without revealing anything was something of a problem. "He thinks the nurse is giving him too much morphine," I finally said. "On purpose."
"That's crazy," Deb said. "She's a nurse."
Harry looked at her but didn't say anything. And to be truthful, I couldn't think of anything to say to Deb's incredible naivete either. "What should I do?" I asked Harry. Harry looked at me for a very long time. At first I thought his mind might have wandered away with the pain, but as I looked back at him, I saw that Harry was very much present. His jaw was set so hard that I thought the bones might snap through his tender, pale skin, and his eyes were as clear and sharp as I had ever seen them, as much as when he had first given me his Harry solution to getting me squared away. "Stop her," he said at last. A very large thrill ran through me. Stop her? Was it possible? Could he mean stop her? Until now, Harry had helped me control my dark passenger, feeding him stray pets, hunting deer. One glorious time I had gone with him to catch a feral monkey that had been terrorizing a South Miami neighborhood. It had been so close, so almost human, but still not right, of course. And we had gone through all the theoretical steps of stalking, disposing of evidence, and so on. Harry knew that someday it would happen, and he wanted me to be ready to do it right. He had always held me back from actually doing it. But now, stop her? Could he mean it? "I'll go talk to the doctor," Deborah said. "He'll tell her to adjust your medicine." I opened my mouth to speak, but Harry squeezed my hand and nodded once painfully. "Go," he said, and Deborah looked at him for a moment before she turned away and went to find the doctor. When she was gone, the room filled with a wild silence. I could think of nothing but what Harry had said, "Stop her." And I couldn't think of any other way to interpret it, except that he was finally turning me loose, giving me permission to do the real thing at last. But I didn't dare ask him if that's what he had said, for fear he would tell me he meant something else. And so I just stood there for the longest time, staring out the small window into a garden outside, where a splatter of red flowers surrounded a fountain. Time passed. My mouth got dry. "Dexter," Harry said at last. I didn't answer. Nothing I could think of seemed adequate. "It's like this," Harry said, slowly and painfully, and my eyes jerked down to his. He gave me a strained half-smile when he saw that I was with him at last. "I'll be gone soon," Harry said. "I can't stop you from being who you are." "Being what I am, Dad," I said. He waved it away with a feeble, brittle hand. "Sooner or later, you will need to do it to a person," he said, and I felt my blood sing at the thought. "Somebody who needs it."
"Like the nurse," I said with a thick tongue.
"Yes," he says, closing his eyes for a long moment. And when he went on, his voice had grown hazy with the pain. "She needs it, Dexter. That's..." He took a ragged breath. I could hear his tongue clacking as if his mouth was overdry. "She's deliberately overdosing patients. Killing them. Killing them on purpose. She's a killer, Dexter. A killer."
I cleared my throat. I felt a little clumsy and lightheaded, but after all, this was a very important moment in a young man's life. "Do you want—" I said, and stopped as my voice broke. "Is it all right if I stop her, Dad?"
"Yes," said Harry. "Stop her."
For some reason, I felt like I had to be absolutely certain.
"You mean, you know, like I've been doing with, you know, the monkey?"
Harry's eyes were closed, and he was clearly floating away on a rising tide of pain. He took a soft and uneven breath.
"Stop the nurse," he said, "like the monkey." His head arched back slightly, and he began to breathe faster, but still very roughly. Well, there it was. Stop the nurse like the monkey. It had a certain wild ring to it, but in my madly buzzing brain, everything was music. Harry was turning me loose. I had permission. We had talked about one day doing this, but he had held me back. Until now. Now. We talked about this, Harry said, eyes still closed. You know what to do.
I talked to the doctor, Deborah said, hurrying into the room. He'll come down and adjust the meds on the chart.
Good, I said, feeling something rise up in me, from the base of my spine and out over the top of my head, an electric surge that jolted through me and covered me like a dark hood. I'll go talk to the nurse.
Deborah looked startled, perhaps at my tone. Dexter, she said.
I paused, fighting to control the savage glee I felt towering up inside me. I don't want any misunderstanding, I said. My voice sounded strange, even to me. I pushed past Deborah before she could register my expression. And in the hallway of that hospice, threading my way between stacks of clean, crisp white linen, I felt the dark passenger become the new driver for the first time. Dexter became understated, almost invisible, the light-colored stripes on a sharp and transparent tiger. I blended in, almost impossible to see, but I was there, and I was stalking, circling in the wind to find my prey. In that tremendous flash of freedom, on my way to do the thing for the first time, sanctioned by Almighty Harry, I receded, faded back into the scenery of my own dark self, while the other me crouched and growled. I would do it at last, do what I had been created to do. And I did.
Chapter 17.
And I had. So long ago, yet the memory still pulsed in me. Of course, I still had that first dry drop of blood on its slide. It was my first, and I could call up that memory any time by taking out my little slide and looking at it. I did every so often. It had been a very special day for Dexter. Last nurse had been first playmate, and she had opened up so many wonderful doors for me. I had learned so much, found out so many new things. But why was I remembering last nurse now? Why did this whole series of events seem to be whipping me back through time? I could not afford a fond remembrance of my first pair of long pants. I needed to explode into action, make large decisions, and begin important deeds, instead of strolling sappily down memory lane, wallowing in sweet memories of my first blood slide. Which, now that I thought of it, I had not collected from Jaworski. It was the kind of tiny, absurdly unimportant detail that turned strong men of action into fidgeting, whimpering neurotics. I needed that slide. Jaworski's death was useless without it. The whole idiotic episode was now worse than a stupid and impulsive foolishness. It was incomplete. I had no slide. I shook my head, trying spastically to rattle two gray cells into the same synapse. I half wanted to take my boat for an early morning spin. Perhaps the salt air would clear the stupidity from my skull. Or I could head south to Turkey Point and hope that the radiation might mutate me back into a rational creature. But instead, I made coffee. No slide, indeed. It cheapened the whole experience. Without the slide, I might as well have stayed home. Or almost, at any rate. There had been other rewards. I smiled fondly, recalling the mix of moonlight and muffled screams. Oh, what a madcap little monster I had been! An episode unlike any of my others. It was good to break out of dull routine from time to time. And there was Rita, of course, but I had no idea what to think about that, so I didn't. Instead, I thought of the cool breeze flowing across the squirming little man who had liked to hurt children. It had almost been a happy time. But of course in 10 years the memory would fade, and without that slide I could not bring it back. I needed my souvenir. Well, we would see. While the coffee brewed, I checked for the newspaper, more out of hope than expectation. It was rare for the paper to arrive before 6:30, and on Sundays it often came after 8. It was another clear example of the disintegration of society that had so worried Harry. Really, now, if you can't get me my newspaper on time, how can you expect me to refrain from killing people? No paper, no matter. Press coverage of my adventures had never been terribly interesting to me, and Harry had warned me about the idiocy of keeping any kind of scrapbook. He didn't need to. I rarely even glanced at the reviews of my performances. This time was a little different, of course, since I had been so impetuous and was mildly worried that I had not covered my tracks properly. I was just a bit curious to see what might be said about my accidental party, so I sat with my coffee for about 45 minutes until I heard the paper thump against the door. I brought it in and flipped it open. Whatever else one can say about journalists, and there is a very great deal, almost an encyclopedia, they are very rarely troubled by memory. The same paper that had so recently trumpeted, "Cops Corral Killer," now screamed, "Iceman's story melts!" It was a long and lovely piece, very dramatically written, detailing the discovery of a badly abused body at a construction site just off Old Cutler Road. A Metro Miami police spokesperson, meaning Detective Laguerta, I was sure, said that it was much too soon to say anything with certainty, but this was probably a copycat killing. The paper had drawn its own conclusions, another thing they are seldom shy about, and was now wondering aloud if the distinguished gentleman in captivity, Mr. Darrell Earl McHale, was actually, in fact, the killer. Or was the killer still at large, as evidenced by this latest outrage upon public morality? Because, the paper carefully pointed out, how could we believe that two such killers could possibly be on the loose at the same time? It was very neatly reasoned, and it occurred to me that if they had spent as much energy and mental power trying to solve the murders, the whole thing would be over by now. But it was all very interesting reading, of course, and it certainly made me speculate. Good heavens! Was it really possible that this mad animal was still running loose? Was anyone safe? The telephone rang. I glanced at my wall clock. It was 6:45. It could only be Deborah. "I'm reading it now," I said into the phone. "You said bigger," Deborah told me. "Splashier." "And this isn't?" I asked with great innocence. "It's not even a hooker," she said. "Some part-time janitor from Ponce Junior High, chopped up at a construction site on Old Cutler. What the hell, Dexter?" "You did know I'm not perfect, didn't you, Deborah?" "It doesn't even fit the pattern. Where's the cold you said would be there? What happened to the small space?" "It's Miami, Deb. People will steal anything." "It's not even a copycat," she said. "It isn't anything like the others. Even Laguerta got that right. She's already said so in print. Damn it all, Dexter. My butt is way out in the wind here, and this is just some random slasher or a drug thing." "It hardly seems fair to blame me for all that." "God damn it, Dex," she said, and hung up. The early morning TV shows spent a full 90 seconds on the shocking discovery of the shattered body. Channel 7 had the best adjectives, but nobody knew any more than the paper. They radiated outrage and a grim sense of disaster that even carried over into the weather forecast, but I'm sure a large part of it was caused by the lack of pictures. Another beautiful Miami day. Mutilated corpses with a chance of afternoon showers. I got dressed and went to work. I admit I had a minor ulterior motive in heading for the office so early, and I beefed it up by stopping for pastries. I bought 2 crullers, an apple fritter, and a cinnamon roll the size of my spare tire. I ate the fritter and 1 cruller as I cheerfully threaded through the lethal traffic. I don't know how I get away with eating so many donuts. I don't gain weight or get pimples. And although that may seem unfair, I can't find it in my heart to complain. I came out reasonably well in the genetic crapshoot. high metabolism, good size and strength, all of which helped me in my hobby. And I have been told that I am not awful to look at, which I believe is meant to be a compliment. I also didn't need a great deal of sleep, which was nice this morning. I had hoped to arrive early enough to beat Vince Masuoka to work, and it seemed that I had. His office was dark when I got there, clutching my white paper bag for camouflage, but my visit had nothing whatever to do with donuts. I scanned his work area quickly, looking for the telltale evidence box labeled Jaworski and yesterday's date. I found it and quickly lifted out a few tissue samples. There might be enough. I pulled on a pair of latex gloves and in a moment had pressed the samples to my clean glass slide. I do realize how stupid it was to take yet another risk, but I had to have my slide. I had just tucked it away in a Ziploc baggie when I heard him come in behind me. I quickly put things back in place and whirled to face the door as Vince came through and saw me. "My God," I said, "you move so silently. So you have had ninja training." "I have two older brothers," Vince said. "It's the same thing." I held up the white paper bag and bowed. "Master, I bring a gift." He looked at the bag curiously. "May Buddha bless you, grasshopper." "What is it?" I tossed him the bag. It hit him in the chest and slid to the floor. "So much for ninja training," I said. "My finely tuned body needs coffee to function," Vince told me, bending to retrieve the bag. "What's in here? That hurt." He reached into the bag, frowning. "It better not be body parts." He pulled out the huge cinnamon roll and eyed it. "Ay, caramba! My village will not starve this year. We are very grateful, grasshopper." He bowed, holding up the pastry. "A debt repaid is a blessing on us all, my child." "In that case," I said, "do you have the case file on the one they found last night off old Cutler?" Vince took a big bite of cinnamon roll. His lips gleamed with frosting as he slowly chewed. "Mmm," he said, and swallowed. "Are we feeling left out?" "If we means Deborah, yes, we are," I said. I told her I'd take a look at the file for her. "Woof," he said, mouthful of pastry. "There's plenty of bud this time." "Forgive me, master," I said. "Your language is strange to me." He chewed and swallowed. "I said, at least there's plenty of blood this time. But you're still a wallflower. Bradley got the call for this one." "Can I see the file?" He took a bite.
"Enough for life."
"Very true, I'm sure, and in English?" Vince swallowed. "I said he was still alive when his leg came off." "Human beings are so resilient, aren't they?" Vince stuck the whole pastry in his mouth and picked up the file, holding it out to me and taking a large bite of the roll at the same time. I grabbed the folder. "I've got to go," I said, "before you try to talk again." He pulled the roll from his mouth. "Too late," he said. I walked slowly back to my little cubbyhole, glancing at the contents of the folder. Gervasio Cesar Martez had discovered the body. His statement was on top of the folder. He was a security guard, employed by Sago Security Systems. He had worked for them for 14 months and had no criminal record. Martez had found the body at approximately 10:17 p.m. and immediately made a quick search of the area before calling police. He wanted to catch the pendejo who had done this thing because no one should do such things, and they had done it when he, Gervasio, was on the job. That was like they had done it to him, you know? So he would catch the monster himself. But this had not been possible. There was no sign of the perpetrator, not anywhere, and so he had called the police. The poor man had taken it personally. I shared his outrage. Such brutality should not be allowed. Of course, I was also very grateful that his sense of honor had given me time to get away, and here I had always thought morality was useless. I turned the corner into my dark little room and walked right into Detective Legerta. "Ha," she said, "you don't see so good." But she didn't move. "I'm not a morning person," I told her. "My biorhythms are all off until noon." She looked up at me from an inch away. "They look okay to me," she said. I slid around her to my desk. "Can I make some small contribution to the full majesty of the law this morning?" I asked her. She stared at me. "You have a message," she said, "on your machine." I looked over at my answering machine. Sure enough, the light was blinking. The woman really was a detective.
"It's some girl," Lagerta said. "She sounds kind of sleepy and happy. You got a girlfriend, Dexter?"
There was a strange hint of challenge in her voice. "You know how it is," I said. "Women today are so forward. And when you are as handsome as I am, they absolutely fling themselves at your head." Perhaps an unfortunate choice of words. As I said it, I couldn't help thinking of the woman's head flung at me not so long ago.
"Watch out," Lagerta said. "Sooner or later one of them will stick."
I had no idea what she thought that meant, but it was a very unsettling image. "I'm sure you're right," I said. "Until then, carpe diem."
"What?"
"It's Latin," I said. "It means complain in daylight."
"What have you got about this thing last night?"
she said suddenly. I held up the case file. "I was just looking at it," I said.
"It's not the same," she said, frowning. "No matter what those asshole reporters say, Mikhail is guilty. He confessed. This one is not the same."
"I guess it seems like too much of a coincidence," I said. "Two brutal killers at the same time." Lagerta shrugged. "It's Miami. What do they think? Here is where these guys come on vacation. There's lots of bad guys out there. I can't catch them all." To be truthful, she couldn't catch any of them, unless they hurled themselves off a building and into the front seat of her car. But this didn't seem like a good time to bring that up. Lagerta stepped closer to me and flicked the folder with a dark red fingernail.
"I need you to find something here, Dexter, to show it's not the same."
A light dawned. She was getting unpleasant pressure, probably from Captain Matthews, a man who believed what he read in the papers, as long as they spelled his name right, and she needed some ammunition to fight back.
"Of course it's not the same," I said. "But why come to me?"
She stared at me for a moment through half-closed eyes, a curious effect. I think I had seen the same stare in some of the movies Rita had dragged me to see, but why on earth Detective Lagerta had turned the look on me, I couldn't say.
"I let you in the 72-hour briefing," she said. "Even though Dokes wants you dead, I let you stay."
"Thank you very much."
"Because you have a feeling for these things sometimes. The serial ones. That's what they all say. Dexter has a feeling sometimes."
"Oh, really?" I said. "Just a lucky guess once or twice.
And I need somebody in the lab who can find something."
"Then why not ask Vince?"
"He's not so cute," she said. "You find something."
She was still uncomfortably close. So close I could smell her shampoo.
"I'll find something," I said.
She nodded at the answering machine.
"You gonna call her back? You don't have time for chasing pussy."
She still hadn't backed up, and it took me a moment to realize she was talking about the message on my machine. I gave her my very best political smile. "I think it's chasing me, detective."
"Ha! You got that right."
She gave me a long look, then turned and walked away. I don't know why, but I watched her go. I really couldn't think of anything else to do. Just before she passed out of sight around the corner, she smoothed her skirt across her hips and turned to look at me. Then she was gone, off into the vague mysteries of homicidal politics. And me? Poor dear dazed Dexter. What else could I do? I sank into my office chair and pushed the play button on my answering machine.
"Hi, Dexter. It's me."
Of course it was. And as odd as it was, the slow, slightly raspy voice sounded like me was Rita.
I was thinking about last night. Call me, mister."
As Lagerta had observed, she sounded kind of tired and happy. Apparently I had a real girlfriend now. Where would the madness end?
Chapter 18.
For a few moments, I just sat and thought about life's cruel ironies. After so many years of solitary self-reliance, I was suddenly pursued from all directions by hungry women. Deb, Rita, Lagerta, they were all apparently unable to exist without me. Yet the one person I wanted to spend some quality time with was being coy, leaving Barbie dolls in my freezer. Was any of this fair? I put my hand in my pocket and felt the small glass slide, snug and secure in its ziplock. For a moment it made me feel a little better. At least I was doing something. And life's only obligation, after all, was to be interesting, which it certainly was at the moment. Interesting did not begin to describe it. I would trade a year off my life to find out more about this elusive will-o'-the-wisp who was teasing me so mercilessly with such elegant work. In fact, I had come far too close to trading more than a year with my little Jaworski interlude. Yes, things were certainly interesting. And were they really saying in the department that I had a feeling for serial homicide? That was very troubling. It meant my careful disguise might be close to unraveling. I had been good too many times. It could become a problem. But what could I do, be stupid for a while? I wasn't sure I knew how, even after so many years of careful observation. Ah, well. I opened the case file on Jaworski, the poor man. After an hour of study, I came to a couple of conclusions. First, and most important, I was going to get away with it. In spite of the unforgivable, sloppy impulsiveness of the thing. And second, there might be a way for Deb to cash in on this. If she could prove this was the work of our original artist, while Laguerta committed herself to the copycat theory, Deb could suddenly turn from somebody they didn't trust to get their coffee into flavor of the month. Of course, it was not actually the work of the same guy, but that seemed like a very picky objection at this point. And since I knew without any possibility of doubt that there were going to be more bodies found very soon, it wasn't worth worrying about. And naturally, at the same time, I had to provide the annoying Detective Laguerta with enough rope to hang herself, which might also, it occurred to me, come in handy on a more personal level. Pushed into a corner and made to look like an idiot, Laguerta would naturally try to pin the blame on the nitwit lab tech who had given her the erroneous conclusion, Dull, Dim, Dexter. And my reputation would suffer a much-needed relapse into mediocrity. Of course, it would not jeopardize my job, since I was supposed to analyze blood spatter, not provide profiling services. That being the case, it would help to make Laguerta look like the nitwit she was, and raise Deborah's stock even more. Lovely when things work out so neatly. I called Deborah. At 1:30 the next day, I met Deb at a small restaurant a few blocks north of the airport. It was tucked into a little strip mall between an auto parts store and a gun shop. It was a place we both knew well, not too far from Miami-Dade headquarters, and they made the best Cuban sandwiches in the world right there. Perhaps that seems like a small thing, but I assure you there are times when only a medianoche will do, and at such times Café Relampago was the only place to get one. The Morgans had been going there since 1974. And I did feel that some small light touch was in order, if not an actual celebration, then at least an acknowledgement that things were looking up ever so slightly. Perhaps I was merely feeling chipper because I had let off a little steam with my dear friend Jaworski, but in any case I did feel unaccountably good. I even ordered a batido de mamey, a uniquely flavored Cuban milkshake that tastes something like a combination of watermelon, peach, and mango. Deb, of course, was unable to share my irrational mood. She looked like she had been studying the facial expressions of large fish, dour and droopy in the extreme. "Please, Deborah," I begged her, "if you don't stop, your face will be stuck like that. People will take you for a grouper." "They're sure not going to take me for a cop," she said, "because I won't be one anymore." "Nonsense," I said. "Didn't I promise?" "Yeah. You also promised that this was going to work. But you didn't say anything about the looks I'd get from Captain Matthews." "Oh, Deb," I said. "He looked at you? I'm so sorry." "Fuck you, Dexter. You weren't there, and it's not your life going down the tubes." "I told you it was going to be rough for a while, Debs." "Well, at least you are right about that. According to Matthews, I am this close to being suspended." "But he did give you permission to use your free time to look into this a little more?" She snorted. "He said, 'I can't stop you, Morgan, but I am very disappointed, and I wonder what your father would have said.'" "And did you say my father never would have closed the case with the wrong guy in jail?" She looked surprised. No, she said. But I was thinking it. How did you know? But you didn't actually say it, did you, Deborah? No, she said. I pushed her glass toward her. Have some mame, sis. Things are looking up. She looked at me. You're sure you're not just yanking my chain? Never, Deb. How could I? With the greatest of ease. Really, sis, you need to trust me. She held my eye for a moment and then looked down. She still hadn't touched her shake, which was a shame. They were very good. I trust you, but I swear to God I don't know why. She looked up at me, a strange expression flitting back and forth across her face. And sometimes I really don't think I should, Dexter. I gave her my very best reassuring big brother smile. Within the next 2 or 3 days, something new will turn up, I promise. You can't know that, she said. I know I can't, Deb, but I do know, I really do. So why do you sound so happy about it? I wanted to say it was because the idea made me happy, because the thought of seeing more of the bloodless wonder made me happier than anything else I could think of. But of course that was not a sentiment Deb could really share with me, so I kept it to myself. Naturally, I'm just happy for you. She snorted. That's right, I forgot, she said. But at least she took a sip of her shake. Listen, I said. Either Lagerta is right, which means I'm dead and fucked, or Lagerta is wrong, and you are alive and virginal. With me so far, sis? She said, remarkably grumpy, considering how patient I was being. If you were a betting gal, would you bet on Lagerta being right? About anything? Maybe about fashion, she said. She dresses really nice. The sandwiches came. The waiter dropped them sourly in the middle of the table without a word and whirled away behind the counter. Still, they were very good sandwiches. I don't know what made them better than all the other medianoches in town, but they were. Bread crisp on the outside and soft on the inside. Just the right balance of pork and pickle. Cheese melted perfectly. Pure bliss. I took a big bite. Deborah played with a straw in her shake. I swallowed. Debs, if my deadly logic can't cheer you up, and one of Relampago's sandwiches can't cheer you up, then it's too late. You're already dead. She looked at me with her grouper face and took a bite of her sandwich. It's very good, she said without expression. See me cheer up? The poor thing was not convinced, which was a terrible blow to my ego. But after all, I had fed her on a traditional Morgan family delight, and I had brought her wonderful news, even if she didn't recognize it as such. If all this had not actually made her smile, well, really, I couldn't be expected to do everything. One other small thing I could do, though, was to feed Lagerta, too. Something not quite as palatable as one of Relampago's sandwiches, though delicious in its own way. And so that afternoon, I called on the good detective in her office, a lovely little cubby in the corner of a large room containing half a dozen other little cubbies. Hers, of course, was the most elegant, with several very tasteful photographs of herself with celebrities hanging from the fabric of the partitions. I recognized Gloria Estefan, Madonna, and Jorge Mascanosa. On the desk, on the far side of a jade-green blotter with a leather frame, stood an elegant green onyx pen holder with a quartz clock in the center. Lagerta was on the telephone speaking rapid-fire Spanish when I came in. She glanced up at me without seeing me and looked away, but after a moment, her eyes came back to me. This time she looked me over thoroughly, frowned, and said, "Okay, okay, talo," which was Cuban for hasta luego. She hung up and continued to look at me. "What have you got for me?" she said finally. "Glad tidings," I told her. "If that means good news, I could use some." I hooked a folding chair with my foot and dragged it into her cubby. "There is no possible doubt," I said, sitting in the folding chair, "that you have the right guy in jail. The murder on old Cutler was committed by a different hand." She just looked at me for a moment. I wondered if it took her that long to process the data and respond. "You can back that up?" she asked me at last. "For sure?" Of course I could back it up for sure, but I wasn't going to, no matter how good confession might be for the soul. Instead, I dropped the folder onto her desk. "The facts speak for themselves," I said. "There's absolutely no question about it." And of course there wasn't any question at all, as only I knew very well. "Look," I told her, and pulled out a page of carefully selected comparisons I had typed out. "First, this victim is male. All the others were female. This victim was found off Old Cutler. All of McHale's victims were off Tamiami Trail. This victim was found relatively intact and in the spot where he was killed. McHale's victims were completely chopped up, and they were moved to a different location for disposal." I went on, and she listened carefully. The list was a good one. It had taken me several hours to come up with the most obvious, ludicrous, transparently foolish comparisons, and I must say I did a very good job. And LaGuardia did her part wonderfully, too. She bought the whole thing. Of course, she was hearing what she wanted to hear. "To sum up," I said, "this new murder has the fingerprint of a revenge killing, probably drug-related. The guy in jail did the other murders, and they are absolutely, positively, 100% finished and over forever. Never happen again. Case closed." I dropped the folder on her desk and held out my list. She took the paper from me and looked at it for a long moment. She frowned. Her eyes moved up and down the page a few times. One corner of her lower lip twitched. Then she placed it carefully on her desk under a heavy jade-green stapler. "Okay," she said, straightening the stapler so it was perfectly aligned with the edge of her blotter. "Okay, pretty good. This should help." She looked at me again with her frown of concentration still stitched in place, and then suddenly smiled. "Okay, thank you, Dexter." It was such an unexpected and genuine smile that if I only had a soul, I'm sure I would have felt quite guilty. She stood, still smiling, and before I could retreat, she had flung her arms around my neck to give me a hug. "I really do appreciate it," she said. "You make me feel very grateful." And she rubbed her body against mine in a way that could only be called suggestive. Surely there could be no question of... I mean, here she was, a defender of public morality, and yet right here in public, and even in the privacy of a bank vault, I would have been truly uninterested in being rubbed by her body, not to mention the fact that I had just handed her a rope with the hope that she would use it to hang herself, which hardly seemed like the sort of thing one would celebrate by... Well, really, had the whole world gone mad? What is it with humans? Is this all any of them ever thinks about? Feeling something very close to panic, I tried to disentangle myself. "Please, detective." "Call me Migdia," she said, clinging and rubbing harder. She reached a hand down to the front of my pants, and I jumped. On the plus side, my action dislodged the amorous detective. On the negative side, she spun sideways, hit the desk with her hip, and tripped over her chair, landing sprawled out on the floor. I really have to get back to work," I stammered. "There's an important, However, I couldn't think of anything more important than running for my life, so I backed out of the cubicle, leaving her looking after me. It didn't seem to be a particularly friendly look. Chapter 19. I woke up standing at the sink with the water running. I had a moment of total panic, a sense of complete disorientation, my heart racing while my crusty eyelids fluttered in an attempt to catch up. The place was wrong. The sink didn't look right. I wasn't even sure who I was. In my dream, I had been standing in front of my sink with the water running, but it had not been this sink. I had been scrubbing my hands, working the soap hard, cleansing my skin of every microscopic fleck of horrible red blood, washing it away with water so hot it left my skin pink and new and antiseptic. And the hot of the water bit harder after the cool of the room I had just left behind me. The playroom, the killing room, the room of dry and careful cutting. I turned off the water and stood for a moment, swaying against the cold sink. It had all been far too real, too little like any kind of dream I knew about. And I remembered so clearly the room I could see it just by closing my eyes. I am standing above the woman, watching her flex and bulge against the tape that holds her, seeing the living terror grow in her dull eyes, seeing it blossom into hopelessness, and I feel the great surge of wonder rise up in me and flow down my arm to the knife, and as I lift the knife to begin. But this is not the beginning, because under the table there is another one, already dry and neatly wrapped, and in the far corner there is one more, waiting her turn with a hopeless black dread unlike anything I have ever seen before, even though it is somehow familiar and necessary. This release of all other possibility, so complete, it washes me with a clean, pure energy more intoxicating than three. There are three of them this time. I opened my eyes. It was me in the mirror. Hello, Dexter. Had a dream, old chap? Interesting, wasn't it? Three of them, hey? But just a dream. Nothing more. I smiled at me, trying out the face muscles, completely unconvinced. And as rapturous as it had been, I was awake now and left with nothing more than a hangover and wet hands. What should have been a pleasant interlude in my subconscious had me shaking, uncertain. I was filled with dread at the thought that my mind had skipped town and left me behind to pay the rent. I thought of the three carefully trussed playmates and wanted to go back to them and continue. I thought of Harry and knew I couldn't. I was whipsawed between a memory and a dream, and I couldn't tell which was more compelling. This was just no fun anymore. I wanted my brain back. I dried my hands and went to bed again, but there was no sleep left in this night for dear decimated Dexter. I simply lay on my back and watched the dark pools flowing across the ceiling until the telephone rang at 5:45. "You were right," Deb said when I picked up. "It's a wonderful feeling," I said with a great effort at being my usual bright self. "Right about what?" "All of it," Deb told me. "I'm at a crime scene on Tamiami Trail, and guess what?" I was right. "It's him, Dexter. It has to be. And it's a whole hell of a lot splashier, too." "Splashier how, Deb?" I asked, thinking three bodies, hoping she wouldn't say it, and thrilled by the certainty that she would. "There appear to be multiple victims," she said. A jolt went through me from my stomach straight up, as if I had swallowed a live battery, but I made a huge effort to rally with something typically clever. "This is wonderful, Deb. You're talking just like a homicide report." "Yeah, well, I'm starting to feel like I might write one someday. I'm just glad it won't be this one. It's too weird. LaGuardia doesn't know what to think." "Or even how. What's weird about it, Deb?" "I gotta go," she said abruptly. "Get out here, Dexter. You have to see this." By the time I got there, the crowd was three deep around the barrier, and most of them were reporters. It is always hard work to push through a crowd of reporters with the scent of blood in their nostrils. You might not think so, since on camera they appear to be brain-damaged wimps with severe eating disorders. But put them at a police barricade, and a miraculous thing happens. They become strong, aggressive, willing and able to shove anything and anyone out of the way and trample them underfoot. It's a bit like the stories about aged mothers lifting trucks when their child is trapped underneath. The strength comes from some mysterious place. And somehow, when there is gore on the ground, these anorexic creatures can push their way through anything, without mussing their hair, too. Luckily for me, one of the uniforms at the barricade recognized me. "Let him through, folks," he told the reporters. "Let him through." "Thanks, Julio," I told the cop. "Seems like more reporters every year." He snorted. "Somebody must be cloning them. They all look the same to me." I stepped under the yellow tape, and as I straightened on the far side, I had the odd sensation that someone was tampering with the oxygen content of Miami's atmosphere. I stood in the broken dirt of a construction site. They were building what would probably be a three-story office building, the kind inhabited by marginal developers. And as I stepped slowly forward, following the activity around the half-built structure, I knew it was not coincidence that we had all been brought here. Nothing was coincidence with this killer. Everything was deliberate, carefully measured for aesthetic impact, explored for artistic necessity. We were at a construction site because it was necessary. He was making his statement, as I had told Deborah he would.
You got the wrong guy, he was saying. You locked up a cretin because you are all cretins. You are too stupid to see it unless I rub your noses in it. So here goes.
But more than that, more than his message to the police and the public, he was talking to me, taunting me, teasing me, by quoting a passage from my own hurried work. He had brought the bodies to a construction site because I had taken Jaworski at a construction site. He was playing catch with me, showing all of us just how good he was and telling one of us, me, that he was watching.
I know what you did, and I can do it too, better.
I suppose that should have worried me a little. It didn't. It made me feel almost giddy, like a high school girl watching as the captain of the football team worked up his nerve to ask for a date.
You mean me? Little old me? Oh, my stars, really? Pardon me while I flutter my eyelashes.
I took a deep breath and tried to remind myself that I was a good girl and I didn't do those things. But I knew he did them, and I truly wanted to go out with him.
Please, Harry?
Because far beyond simply doing some interesting things with a new friend, I needed to find this killer. I had to see him, talk to him, prove to myself that he was real and that... That what? That he wasn't me? That I was not the one doing such terrible, interesting things? Why would I think that? It was beyond stupid. It was completely unworthy of the attention of my once proud brain. Except, now that the idea was actually rattling around in there, I couldn't get the thought to sit down and behave. What if it really was me? What if I had somehow done these things without knowing it? Impossible, of course, absolutely impossible. But I wake up at the sink washing blood off my hands after a dream in which I carefully and gleefully got blood all over my hands doing things I ordinarily only dream about doing. Somehow I know things about the whole string of murders, things I couldn't possibly know unless nothing.